Hello, my name is Doug Wetmore, and I'm with Firefighters for Christ. Once in a while, a set of tapes comes along that is so informative you just can't wait to put it out. However, in this case, we hesitated. For one, there is a recording flaw in the first two tapes that have an electronic hum or static that is a little annoying and uncorrectable. Second, this is a hard topic and can be depressing if your faith in Christ wavers at all. This message is a hard, sobering look at the reality in the military planning and preparedness of the Soviet Union. Yet we feel is very truthful and honest. After all, a man's decisions are no better than the information he has to make them. Jeff Nyquist is well-read, well-informed, and the author of the book, The Origins of the Fourth World War. These four tapes are a review of his book with Dr. Stanley Monteith from Radio Liberty. And now let's join Dr. Stan in a radio program given on December the 30th. 1998.
The supporters of this station, they happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and if you're out there in Radio Land and you have a question or comment at any time, we welcome your calls here at 464-8295 or at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But of course, let me ask you to hold your calls for the time being, because we're going to be talking about a book by J.R. Nyquist called The Origins of the Fourth World War and the Coming Wars of Mass Destruction. Are you there?
Yes, I am, Stan.
Thanks so very much. What shall I call you?
Jeff.
Jeff. Okay, Jeff. And how did you happen to write this article, this book? Because it's really quite fascinating.
I was in graduate school 11, 12 years ago, and I met people in seminars and colloquium who worked for the State Department and the Pentagon and the RAND Corporation. And when the topic of World War would come up, I found their views peculiar. I felt there was an evasion. There were certain things you didn't talk about, certain ideas you didn't delve into, and this fascinated me because there's a kind of sociology of knowledge going on. Whenever people evade or blot out reality, it either means that there is some kind of distortion going on, or there's just simple fear and cowardice to confront basic truths.
Well, now, what were you taking? What sort of courses were you taking in graduate school?
Your basic to get a political science PhD. It's political science.
Okay, so you took a degree in political science. Did you go on and get your master's or doctorate? Or
I was in a PhD program for 2 years. But no, I was unable to finish. I'd found that the school was so imbued with a kind of radicalism, soft and also hard Marxism, that my views were considered fascist, that I believed in America and the Constitution, and liberty made me some kind of a fascist.
And so they, of course, this university, like so many of the others, really wasn't interested in truth, wasn't interested in study, wasn't interested in academic freedom. They were interested in indoctrination.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there were good people at the university. There were people who were had active minds and weren't caught up in this. But unfortunately, the most politically active kind of set a tone of intimidation for everyone.
But this is true on university campuses across America. There are very few universities in the United States today where there is any such thing as academic freedom except for communist radicals and those who hate America.
Yeah, that is very prevalent, which really astonished me, because at the University of California 11, 12 years ago, I also was a teaching assistant. In order to teach, you had to swear an oath of allegiance to the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of California. And of course, that oath, it contains within it the phrase to defend against enemies foreign and domestic.
Right, but of course, these people wouldn't mind swearing an oath, because oath means nothing to them, because they don't believe in right and wrong. They believe in the ultimate victory of world socialism.
Yeah, evidently they all swore to it, and I remember I was working for a professor at the University of California at Irvine, and Mark Petraca, and he said at one of our teacher meetings, we were teaching Introduction to Political Science, he said, I want you to go out and make little Marxists out of the students. I was kind of stunned. I didn't expect it to be presented to me that bald-facedly, and most of the graduate students really weren't Marxists, although many are have that kind of view. These ones weren't, and you know what? I was the only one who piped up to protest it.
I can remember when I was a undergraduate at the University of California, 1946, and being in a public speaking course and being asked to read a book on communism and then prepare a paper. And I remember, of course, in those days I was pre-med, and it was very important to get straight A's. And I wrote this beautiful paper, I thought it was, and I got a B on it. And I went to see the teaching assistant, and he told me, quite frankly, that I wasn't enthusiastic enough about the Bolshevik Revolution. I didn't understand how wonderful it was now that they had a situation in Russia where everybody was guaranteed life, liberty, property, health, education, and welfare. And so, of course, the next paper that I wrote on the same subject, and why in public speaking I was writing papers on communism and the communist revolution, I didn't understand at the time. I do understand now, but the next paper I was very praiseworthy of the Marxist revolution, and voila, I got a straight A, and after that I started getting straight A's in my speeches. And in fact, I was 16 years old at the time, and I remember the professor always, every time he'd see me, he'd shout out, "Hey, straight A, Monteith!" And I would just sort of swell up, you know, I was so important. But of course, I didn't realize that they were using the Pavlovian technique of rewards in return for the proper response. And I came to believe a lot of this garbage and so much of that. And that was 1946, University of California at Berkeley. So it didn't really start 12 years ago. It's been going along for a long time. This effort to destroy the basic foundations upon which our country was once built. Well, your book is really fascinating, and you certainly go a lot into the background of the philosophy. I thought that you're pointing out that all this garbage about the fall of Russia, the fall of communism, now that all of the slave labor camps are closed in the gulag, and of course your remark on, I guess it was page 6 of the introduction, that the situation in the camps of Russia and the Ukraine, as well as in other parts of the USSR, with the exception of the Baltic states, has not changed. And yet, of course, I can remember the programs where they had Barbara Walters and other pundits from CBS, the communist broadcasting system, going to Russia and showing us all those empty camps where one time people had been enslaved, but now, of course, all the slave labor camps were gone. Do you believe that they're all gone?
No, they've been enlarged in size. They have not shrunk.
But of course our media doesn't tell us that, do they?
No, generally they don't. It's bad news, and it's not exactly what the stock market people want to hear either.
Well, of course, you go into the whole idea that a country that really won't stand for anything will almost fall for anything. And you pointed out that studying ancient history, the single surest observation is that economically advanced states often suffer defeat at the hands of less advanced states. Thus did Greek triumph over Persia, Sparta over Athens, Macedonia over the rest of Greece, Rome over Carthage, and the barbarians over Rome. I thought that was a beautiful statement.
Yeah, it's something that we don't think about. We assume automatically that the more advanced civilization always wins. And we look at the communists, the Chinese, and the Russians, and we see how backward and barbaric they are. I mean, Chinese society, although there's many wonderful Chinese people, there's a barbarism in at large in Chinese society that is shocking to Western people. I remember my business partner, he went to China a few years ago, and he visited one of their more advanced economic areas, and there was an Australian woman with him on the tour, and she saw these barefooted children in rags begging for food, and she just burst into tears. I mean, it was so sad, the condition of the people in China. And this is China after it's had a big boom.
Right. Of course, nobody ever wants to talk about the 60 to 80 million people who were systematically executed as they brought about this wonderful social experiment in China, that social experiment that David Rockefeller referred to in 1972 as this wonderful socialist experiment in a controlled society, which is, of course, exactly what the Rockefellers and the other people of great wealth have been doing throughout the world, and which they will accomplish here if they have their way. Now, of course, one of the points you really go into in the book, I thought was very, very important. You talked a lot about a man named Anatoly Golitsyn. And would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about him? Because you've quoted extensively from him in the book and his views as far as the fall of Russia and, of course, as the far as the so-called Sino-Soviet split. And why don't you just pick up that idea? Because I think it's so important that our listeners understand that most of what they've been told by the controlled media in America has been simply a lie.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you what a leading defense analyst told me when I was in Washington last August. He said, Anatoly Golitsyn is probably the most brilliant political and intelligence analyst that has ever lived. And he's a Russian KGB major who defected in 1961, who had worked in a KGB think tank for KGB chairman Alexander Shalapin. And in this think tank, its mission was to devise a reorganization of the KGB to carry out a long-range deception strategy, which would involve the creation of phony dissident movement in Russia, the creation of false democracy and false liberalism and capitalism in Russia that would be controlled by secret agents of the communist regime. This liberalization would be so spectacular, Golitsyn explains in his 1984 book, New Lies for Old, that it would include the collapsing of the Berlin Wall, the Communist Party giving up its monopoly of power, the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact Alliance. In fact, Golitsyn's 1984 book, in which he recapitulates all of the things that he learned about this deception strategy when he worked in this think tank in the late 1950s, he distilled it into about 138 predictions. And a political scientist went through those predictions in 1992 and found that 93% of them had come true.
He talked about the Solidarity movement taking over Poland,
yes.
How Czechoslovakia would appear to be going into the communist camp, and, of course, how East Germany would be united with West Germany. It was all part of a long-range plan that was put forward by the KGB to deceive the West. And, of course, as the West disarmed, the Russians would be in full military protection.
What's interesting is that I didn't believe Golitsyn when I read his book in 1984. I thought that perhaps these ideas had been discussed, that maybe they made a start at doing something like that, but I did not believe that the tools and the instruments of deception were sufficient enough to pull off such a thing. It was only in 1987 when I actually met members of our own intelligence establishment that I realized that their mentality was inadequate to cope with this kind of strategy. And I realized for the first time that it could work. And I also found in 1987, against what many books claimed, there was another defector who confirms many of the things that Golitsyn had to say. There was a defector named Jan Sena, who was the highest ranking defector of all time. He was a major general and a secretary in the Communist Czechoslovakian Defense Council, who defected in 1968. And in 1982, Sena wrote a book called We Will Bury You. In that book, he stated, he talked about a plan, a long-range plan that he was shown in 1967, that the East Bloc countries were to become participants in. And this plan called for the eventual dissolution of the Warsaw Pact in order to effect the disarmament of NATO. And there were other things. A fascinating detail he offered is that the communists in the Eastern Bloc countries were ordered to infiltrate Tito's Yugoslavia so that after Tito's death, they would break up Yugoslavia along ethnic lines.
And that's just, of course, what they've done, which is the basis of the conflict we're seeing there now.
Right.
There was a fascinating book. It was called Solo, and it was the story of the second highest ranking man in the American Communist Party, who was actually a FBI undercover agent.
Yes.
Who was always, I don't know if you ever read it, but I think it was
written
by John Barron.
Yes, in fact, I'm nearly done reading it right now.
And, of course, this fellow was going over to Moscow and then hobnobbing with the leading communists, and they were always giving him information, telling him the real inside information about the Soviet split. Then he would be met when he arrived back in the United States by the FBI, taken and debriefed. He would bring all this money in for the American Communist Party, and they would count it all and get the numbers on the bills and give it back to him so he could finance the American Communist Party. Then he would go back over to Moscow. He'd be met by the KGB at the airport, taken into the Kremlin and given all this information, which he would then take back to America. Yeah. And, you know, I can't believe that the KGB is stupid enough not to know that this so-called agent that they have working within America is being met at the airport by the FBI. Well, I mean, obviously, they were feeding him disinformation, and the disinformation they were sending him was the fact that there was a split between the Russians and the Chinese communists, and that became the reality for the American establishment. And at one time, I think you probably read the book, you find that they were concerned about perhaps his exposure, his life might be in danger. They wanted to discontinue this whole charade, and Henry Kissinger came and said, oh no, you've got to continue. And of course, my feeling is that Henry Kissinger wanted to continue feeding the disinformation to the American intelligence establishment. Did that idea ever cross your mind as you read the book?
Oh yes, there's no doubt. The tradecraft used by the FBI is so poor that there's no way that the KGB didn't see through it from the beginning. And what's fascinating is that here is the second highest man in the Communist Party USA, Mr. Morris, who is traveling to Moscow, then to Beijing, and he hears these bitter comments by Zhou Enlai and Mao Zedong about the Soviets, and these bitter comments by Boris Ponomarev and Mikhail Suslov and Brezhnev about the Chinese. Now, what's interesting is that the people who formulated this long-range strategy in Russia, it was the Brezhnev Committee. Brezhnev became head of the Soviet Union because he was in charge of the committee that created the long-range strategy.
Sure.
And his deputy on that committee was Mikhail Suslov, and the head of the foreign policy part of the plan to come up with it was Boris Ponomarev. So these are the top strategists of the Soviet Union. And the same thing with Deng Xiaoping and Zhou Enlai and Mao Zedong. And that these people are going to talk to some American, second-rate American communist flunky and tell him all their secrets so that he can patter on back to Washington to tell them what he just said. It absolutely, the fact that the FBI believed this, the fact that J. Edgar Hoover and our policy making bodies accepted this stuff uncritically, shows you that the American mentality simply does not grasp the mechanics of Cold War espionage and tradecraft.
Of course, you dedicate your book to James Angleton. How do you pronounce that word, name, Angleton?
Yes, Angleton.
And, of course, he was the one who actually believed Gallitzin. He believed that this whole breakdown of the Soviet Union was phony. He believed that they were going to be playing games with us. They were manipulating us at the highest echelons of our government. And because he believed that, of course, he was purged. And was it Colby who got rid of him?
Yes, it was William Colby, the man who met with this mysterious canoeing accident two summers ago, who purged James Angleton. Actually, I guess it was three summers ago he met with the accident, who purged James Angleton in late 1974, and along with many members of the counterintelligence staff who were forced out when Angleton was. Angleton realized that the KGB had penetrated the CIA at many levels, and he couldn't find the moles. The CIA security at the CIA was so lax, and of course we found out this even more profoundly in the case of Aldridge Ames, a falling down drunk who had given away all the spies that we had in Russia, a man who should have never been promoted, should have never even been allowed in the CIA. And then to find an even higher level KGB mole in the CIA a couple of years later, Mr. Nicholson, who was arrested, I believe, November of 1996.
Was he the head of the anti-communist movement, of the counter-espionage movement in the CIA? Was he the one that they followed for so many years?
Was who the one?
Mr. Nicholson.
Mr. Nicholson was actually in charge of training CIA agents, and he was giving lists of their names as they were going through training with descriptions of them, probably psychological profiles of them, to the KGB.
Sure.
Actually, I should call it the SVR. Since they're into changing names, there's one thing I want to tell your listeners about this idea of the changing of the names. You know, if you look at the book 1984 by George Orwell, which he talks about how totalitarian state operates, he mentions this idea that their dictionary keeps getting smaller every year. The Newspeak dictionary, he calls it, and they take words away from people, because if you take words away from people, then they can't express certain ideas. And what the Soviets have done is they've taken away some basic words for us that we use to describe our enemy. They've taken away the word KGB, they've taken away the word communist, they've taken away the word Soviet. And you know what's interesting is that this game that they play with names, if Charlie Manson were released from prison tomorrow and moved into your neighborhood under the name of Donald Duck, it would still be Charlie Manson underneath. Because the essence of the person is not the same as the name. And the oligarchy over there in the Russian Federation is the same old sorry bunch that we had before under the Soviet Union, and they've got the same kind of motivation. There was an article on this Yevgeny Primakov, this new prime minister of Russia, about a meeting he had with Benjamin Netanyahu. J. Michael Lawler had it in Insight magazine a few months back. He said that Primakov referred to his country three times in his discussions with Netanyahu as the Soviet Union instead of as the Russian Federation. How's that for a slip?
Right. Well, they understand that nothing has really changed. We're not supposed to understand it. Of course, here in America, they've distorted the word liberal and right and left. And, you know, they've changed American Negroes to American blacks, and then from American blacks to African Americans. And they just keep playing these games. They've converted our republic into a democracy, and they are able to convince people of whatever they want to because they have come to control the language. And yes, you're absolutely right. It's 1940, 1984, all over again.
Yeah, it is. And to get back to the Sino-Soviet split, you mentioned this book by John Barrow, Operation Solo, which is, I think, a tremendously naive book, which is a tremendous statement showing that the Sino-Soviet split, there's something fundamentally false in it.
Right, and yet I don't think John Barron understood that, which is really rather surprising. Man, of course, when you understand that the Reader's Digest, which employs him, is part of the establishment, perhaps that isn't so surprising either. But go ahead.
But of course, I think John, what's great about the book is it's done in such innocence that he presents the facts impeccably, that really those same facts, if they're looked at by a true analyst, can see that it clearly shows the fakeness of the split. I found other evidence. I had a chance in last August to meet Colonel Stanislav Brunev.
Oh, you did? I bet that was fascinating.
Who is he's the highest-ranking defector from the main intelligence directorate of the Russian General Staff.
The GRU, right.
Yes, the GRU, as it's called. And, of course, trained by the Russian General Staff to be a spy. He speaks fluent Chinese. And in fact, he served a number of years as a spy for the Soviet Union in Communist China. And he said something most staggering when I was with him privately. He said, you know, certain things I saw in China back in the 80s led me to believe there was a secret alliance at that time between Russia and China, he said to me.
Well, of course, we had the unique opportunity of spending an hour with him, of course, not personally, but on the radio. Perhaps he was a little more guarded in what he said, but he certainly gave a tremendous exposure of the lie that we're being told by our media that pointed out that the communists still believe that they are going to win the Cold War. They believe nuclear war is not only fightable but winnable. They have their agents here. They have their nuclear bombs here. They have their various agents readily available to be used on the American people when the word is given, when the time comes.
Yes.
And, of course, the average American who thinks that this can't happen here is like the average German who thinks that Adolf Hitler would never allow Germany to be destroyed.
Right. Well, you know, at one point in our discussion, and I met with him last month, too, and I've talked to him on the phone, he looked at me at one point and he said, why aren't Americans more patriotic? And I said, because they're too busy having fun and shopping.
Well, of course, that is one of the great problems we have, is the affluence. And, of course, people have lost any concept of what freedom is about, or that freedom is never free.
Yes.
And when people are not willing to fight and perhaps die for freedom, they're certainly going to lose it. And I wonder how many people, other than a very small cadre, would be willing to give their lives today for their nation.
I think that you have to really appreciate what you have, truly, to make that kind of sacrifice for it.
Well, I think that, you know, people will sacrifice for an ideal, something they really believe in, for these ideas of freedom or betterment of mankind. But not for materialism, not for material well-being. not for Monday Night Football. That's not something that's really worthwhile fighting and dying for.
Yeah, that's true. I think there is something in the human heart like that. But, you know, about the Sino-Soviet split, I was going to say what Colonel Lunev told me. There was something additional. I have always, the other book that indicates the split is false is a book that was written by Yao Ming Li. It was formerly a classified document, which was declassified, called The Conspiracy and Death of Lin Biao. I don't know if you've ever heard
of
it.
No, I haven't, really. Lin Biao, now this is the Chinese general who commanded the troops that attacked across the Yalu back in 1950?
No, actually, he never commanded in Korea. Okay. He was the head of the People's Liberation Army.
But is this General Lin Biao?
Yes.
Well, but he had, in fact, if you read MacArthur's reminiscences, you'll find a reference to him where he said, and I would never have risked my troops and my military reputation and attacked across the Yalu had I not been guaranteed that but Washington would restrain MacArthur from taking action against my lines of communication and my troops.
Right. Well, of course, Lin Biao didn't directly command the army.
No.
He was the head of the People's Liberation Army.
Okay, fine. Well, he allowed it, but he may not have been in a position of direct command. But that certainly shows that quotation. You'll find it in both MacArthur's reminiscences and in Courtney, Major General Courtney Whitney's book, MacArthur's Rendezvous with History. Mm-hmm. And it showed that Lin Biao had access to factions in Washington, D.C. that even General Douglas MacArthur didn't have access to.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what was, tell us about the book, about the death of Lin Biao.
Well, what's fascinating is Lin Biao was the number two man in China. He was considered to be second only to Mao. He was head of the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese military. And in 1971, which was in the middle of this period of these border incidences between Russia and China, it seems that the United States developed a spy inside the Chinese General Staff. It's not sure exactly who it was or what it was, but the Chinese found it necessary to send this defector over with this story, the conspiracy and death of Lin Biao. And, of course, we all probably, those who remember their history, probably remember Lin Biao fled from China in an aircraft with the people close to him to the Soviet Union, and his plane was shot down over Mongolia, and he was killed. And of course, what Yao Ming Li claims is that Lin Biao was engaged in a conspiracy to overthrow Mao. And what's fascinating about this conspiracy is that Lin Biao, apparently, as the head of the Chinese army, had a secret liaison with the Soviet General Staff to create a phony border war between Russia and China that would force Mao into his bunker so that Lin Biao could gas Mao and take China over. Now, this story is so improbable in and of itself. The story, I believe, was concocted by Chinese officials and given to Yao Ming Li to explain the discovery by the Americans, and I believe there was a discovery that the Chinese and Russian general staffs were working together to create a phony border incident, because I believe the border incidents in Russia were fabricated, basically, between the Russian and Chinese staffs. But
right.
what this does is it... now, how do I prove... How can you prove this? Well, what's interesting is that I asked Colonel Lunev if he knew anything about the conspiracy and death of Lin Biao, and Colonel Lunev said yes. He had a friend who was involved in the investigation of the air crash in Mongolia of Lin Biao's plane. So I asked him, I said, well, what did they find? He said, well, Lin Biao and all the bodies on the plane, they had been killed before they were put on the plane. The pilot had flown the plane from China to Mongolia, and just inside the Mongolian border, Mongolia is controlled by the Soviet Union, the pilot parachuted out and allowed the plane to crash, so the plane was not shot down.
Hmm.
It was a completely phony, the whole thing was staged. It was a completely phony incident. And I asked Colonel Lunev, I said, well, this incident, since the Chinese knew you would recover the bodies and do autopsies, this incident was not meant to fool you. This was meant to fool the Americans.
And he said, that's right.
Right.
That's fascinating. Is that book still available? That's one I've never read.
Conspiracy and Death of... You might have to do a book search to get it.
All right, we're going to have to take a break here, Jeff. And when we get back, why, we'll open it up the lines for questions, and we'll let people know how to get copies of your book. But hang on there. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and it's the time of our program, and we have to remind you that we are listener-supported. And, of course, we depend upon you out there in the listening audience to do what we do, to bring you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. The programs like this you're not going to hear on the major network radio or television programs. You're not going to hear the detailed analysis that our guest is giving tonight, and the insight that Radio Liberty will give to interviews that will help you to better understand that most of what you get through the media is simply disinformation and misinformation. But, of course, how can the people be both ignorant and free? And, of course, as Jefferson said, there's no way they can. What we have to do is inform the American people, or else our system of government will cease to work. And I hate to say this, but I've been at this game for 36 years now, and approaching 36. One of the most shocking years of your entire life, I can promise you that. So my plea to you is help us. We have now 20 stations. We need to be on 200 stations, and we can't do it without your help. And we have people all across America, really all across the world, who are getting our material, and in other countries there are people who are helping us, and we hope that people here in America value their freedom enough to make a commitment to support Radio Liberty. Now, we're not tax deductible, and if you give us a gift, why, it is not going to be a tax deductible gift, because our goal is to be able to tell you the truth and not have an IRS investigation happen, as has happened so often to people who've tried to tell the truth here in America. You, of course, can join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. A suggested gift would be $20 a month or more, but whatever you could offer, and ordinarily we will send people who support us the four best tapes of the month out of the 60 hours of interviews I do. You'll get our monthly newsletter, which will give you an entirely different slant on the news. But more than that, you'll be part of what we do, the mailings that we do, the tapes that we send out, the videos that we produce. Let me tell you, I got a letter from England today pointing out that our video on the Brotherhood of Darkness, going into the background of the spiritual aspect of the struggle in which we're engaged, that video has been circulated to some of the highest-ranking people within the British government, and has recently been taken to Ukraine, to the Ukraine, and transferred into Ukrainian. So I was tickled. That sort of made my whole day to think that the efforts from our little ministry is having an impact not only across Great Britain, but also across the world. So you can become part of our effort. I can't do it alone. We have a very small staff. There's my wife and son and my secretary and Dave Wilson, and all of these people are working their heart out to try to get the information out, to let people understand that behind the political, behind the ideological battle, there is a spiritual battle. For without understanding that nature of the spiritual battle, it's impossible to understand what's really going on today. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-544-8927. And help us, if you will. And, of course, tell other people to listen to our programs. They can be heard 3 hours a day on the Internet at www.radioliberty.com, on shortwave at WHRI, 4:30 to 5 every day, Monday through Friday on 5.745 megahertz. We have programs in Washington, D.C. We have programs in Los Angeles. But we need your help, quite frankly. I'm looking forward to hearing from you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and if you'd like to talk to our guest this evening, his name is Jeff Nyquist. His book, Origins of the Fourth World War and the Coming Wars of Mass Destruction. Why, you can reach us here at Radio Liberty at 464-8295 if you're on the Central Coast, or out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Jeff, how can people get copies of your book?
Well, they can write to P.O. Box 4931, Eureka, California. That's E-U-R-E-K-A, California, zip code 95502.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to Jeff Nyquist. And to spell my last name is N-Y-Q-U-I-S-T. And if they send a check for $15, I'll send them a copy of the book and a sample of my newsletter.
All right, fine. Well, we'd sort of like to see you. How often do you put your newsletter out?
Once a month.
All right, fine. And well, I think it's important. I think you've got a lot of excellent material here that really needs to be read. In fact, we may even consider carrying this book because I think that there's a great deal of importance in it. Our telephone number, if you'd like to call us here, is 464-8295, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. One of the analogies you used was that the split between the Russians and the Chinese was sort of like a pair of scissors. The two sides, and of course the people who believed in the split got caught in the middle between the blades.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, you think of China and Russia being against each other, but two blades of the scissors are actually aiming against each other, but they slice what is in between them.
Absolutely.
And we're seeing now, this is another one of Golitsyn's predictions. He predicted that at the end of the long-range strategy, Russia and China would then suddenly unite into one clenched fist, and they would draw their allies in with them. And you see now this effort to bring India and now perhaps Pakistan into a larger alliance encompassing the most powerful states of Asia.
Right. And I thought some of the remarks you point out, that Joseph Stalin had said atomic bombs are meant to frighten those with weak nerves. And so what they have done is really frighten the American foreign policy establishment into saying, well, nuclear warfare is just so horrible. We won't even contemplate it. That's why we will go along with mutual assured destruction, because no rational person would ever contemplate nuclear war. Therefore, we will not try to defend the American public. Therefore, we will not have a civil defense system. We will disband any effort to protect our people. And at the same time, the Russians were deploying the anti-ballistic missile system. They were working to build a civilian defense system to protect their people, because they believe that nuclear and chemical and biological warfare are not only fightable, but they're winnable.
Yeah, their efforts in that area of creating underground spaces for their people are absolutely astounding. They have built under Yamato Mountain in the southern Urals a city more than 1,000 feet underground, the size of metropolitan Washington. It is riddled with rail and road tunnels for hiding rail and road mobile ICBMs, and underneath all the major cities of the former Soviet Union are cities beneath the cities, networks of tunnels, nuclear-proof bunkers, towns, and villas, in which, according to Richard F. Starr, one of the ambassadors of our arms control talks, they have stockpiled 362 million metric tons of grain.
In fact, we've been giving them the grain to stockpile in many instances.
Yes, they pretend to have these really nasty famines, and we don't know how nasty they really are. And we give them gratis or give them loans to acquire huge quantities of grain. In fact, this business of their oil industry, they have been, in the last 8 months, stockpiling tremendous reserves of oil, setting aside.
You think they're preparing for the war?
It looks like, since Primakov came in, that was the signal to begin preparations, more immediate war preparations, yes.
And I think for our listeners out there, Primakov is a longtime member of the KGB. He is now, is he the president or the prime minister?
He is the prime minister, which means he is the head of the government.
Right.
Whereas Yeltsin is the head of state, just like the Queen of England is the head of state, right, of the United Kingdom.
And I think that people have to understand that the Russians really are planning on war. In fact, you've of course, talked to Stanislaus Lunev, and is he concerned about the imminence of the war? Because here's former colonel in the Soviet GRU, and in his book he makes it quite clear that it's only a matter of time that before we have a war, and it is booked through the eyes of the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
He brings that out so clearly.
Yes, he states in his book, as a matter of fact, he states that even after the change to the Russian Federation, the Russian General Staff maintains that war with the United States is inevitable. That is a very strong word to use, the word inevitable.
Right.
And of course, this is why they are so seriously creating defenses for themselves. William Lee, a former Defense Intelligence Agency official, recently came forward with a book on the ABM treaty fraud, saying that the Russians, not only have they violated the ABM treaty, which only allows each side to have 100 interceptor missiles, but that they have gone way beyond 100. They have 10 to 12,000.
Right, and of course the thing is that we had interceptor missiles, and we destroyed them during the Carter administration.
Yes.
People don't understand that, and the Russians went ahead and built them and continue building them. And you're absolutely right. They have between 10 and 12,000 interceptor missiles. They have a system by which they can disperse, although perhaps not as sophisticated as we would have, the brilliant pebbles to bring in the missiles. They have developed the technology with our help to use to destroy us.
Yeah, in fact, the technological achievements of the Russians in recent months and years is astounding. You know, they accomplished the first satellite launch from a ballistic missile submarine here last summer. That is astonishing achievement. And
they accomplished the first satellite launch from what? A ballistic missile?
From a ballistic missile submarine.
Oh, ballistic missile submarine. No, okay.
From a submarine. Yeah.
Right. I didn't realize that.
And of course, Boris Yeltsin, when he first came into power, he said he was going to halt production of submarines. He was going to stop Russia building subs. Well, Russia has been building submarines at the same rate the Soviets built them. And their submarine fleet right now, the United States has 18 ballistic missile submarines, and the Russian Federation has 42 ballistic missile submarines.
Of course, the interesting thing is that they've continued building the nuclear attack submarines, and the purpose of them is to kill our submarines.
Yes, yes. The modified Akulas and other attack submarines are absolutely... According to the British Navy, the British claim that these are quieter and deadlier, these Russian ships, undersea warships, quieter and deadlier than anything any Western navies can put to sea.
And, of course, what they have is a dual titanium hull, so you can hit the outer hull, and then they have an inner hull to protect them.
That's right. That's
and,
right.
Of course, they are so silent and they're so so powerful. And, of course, it's all been built with American money. We've been funding them, and I'm sure that much of the technology they've stolen from us, not that they are incapable of coming up with some of the technology, but most of it's American technology. They've simply either been stolen or been given by our leaders like Henry Kissinger.
Yeah, and of course Henry Kissinger was accused of being a GRU spy by a Polish Colonel General of Intelligence named Michael Golanowski, who defected in the early 60s and had acquired by accident a list of agents of the Rotkapelle, that's the Red Orchestra, in Europe. They were agents that were recruited from the American occupation forces, and of course Henry Kissinger was a military intelligence officer in the occupation of Germany in the U.S. Army. And according to Golanowski, he saw Kissinger's name on this list of GRU agents that came accidentally into his possession.
Igor Golanowski, this is a fascinating, fascinating book. You obviously are very, very well read in this field, and it's a pleasure finding somebody who has a background as thorough as yours. It's rather unusual in this day of Monday Night Football and to find somebody who spends their time enjoying books as much as I do.
Yeah, well, of course, a lot of these books have an immediate bearing on our own future well-being.
We certainly do. And I think that the American people had better wake up, because if they do not wake up, then there is no possibility that America will survive.
No, these weapons of mass destruction that have been created can do things that previous armies were not able to do. You can depopulate countries, you can wipe out huge urban concentrations. You can change the demography of whole continents.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was in Germany after the Second World War as a military officer, and I shall never forget I was stationed in Mainz, and behind the facade of the new buildings, new shops there, you look behind them, there's just nothing but rubble as far as you could see.
Mm.
And that was done with conventional bombs. And, literally millions of Germans who lost their lives in the saturation bombing. We never talk about them.
No.
And, of course, many of them were civilians, had no possible allegiance at all to Adolf Hitler. They were simply trapped in this scissors movement between our leaders and the Germans. And, of course, the German generals kept trying to surrender, and our leaders would not think of it, and that's beautifully covered in Wedemeyer's book. Time and again, the German generals tried to surrender, and there was no way we would allow it on one hand. And then, of course, our leaders, instead of doing what was logical in attacking the heartland of Europe and ending the war to stop the suffering, we invaded North Africa, and then we invaded Italy so we could fight up a narrow peninsula, losing as many men on both sides as humanly possible. And that, of course, is the part of the story that is never, never, never discussed today.
Right.
Well, now, some of the other points that you talk about, you know, that certainly there has been a few people who've tried to point out what was going on. You have many references to Whitaker Chambers, certainly one of the great writers of our time, a man who was instrumental in shaping my view of the world. And you quote him as saying at one point, I'm leaving the winning side to join the losing side, talking about leaving communism to join the West. I thought that was such a touching quotation.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, that came up when I was with Colonel Lunev, and a journalist that I was with quoted Chambers' statement to Colonel Lunev, and Colonel Lunev said, well, we were the winning side. And it was a very chilling thing to say.
Right, well, of course, the quotation I had, I think you had the quotation from his book, Witness. The
yes.
Quotation I read was, I think, from Cold Friday, where he talked about going to see this priest who was a very good friend of his who was dying. And he, at one point, he said, do you think God will save the West? And the priest replied, what makes you think that the West is worth saving? And then at another point, he made the quote, observation, I have left the winning side to join the losing side because I would rather die as a free man than live under communism.
Yeah, I think that we have to cultivate that understanding. I mean, Whitaker Chambers had such a deep understanding of communism from having been a communist that this would just reach such a deep level with him that he had, I mean, he obviously suffered greatly having to accuse Alger Hiss, who I think he liked. He didn't want to ruin his life. And, you know, Whitaker Chambers was a retiring person, quiet person, who just wanted to live his life and to deal with his life. And there he was. He had to engage in this arduous trial to get this Alger Hiss fellow, who was a communist agent that he knew when he was in the communist movement, to get him convicted. And of course, at first, the whole establishment, I think that a lot of the establishment today still thinks Chambers was a bad guy.
Well, I'll never forget what Chambers said of Hiss. He was accused of hating Hiss. You know, you hate him, that's why you're trying to destroy this,
right,
this man. And he said, hate him? I could never hate a man who agrees with me that life is not worth living for which a man is not willing to die at any moment. And I've never forget that. I think that is one of the most powerful statements I've ever read, that life is not worth living for which a man is not willing to die at any moment.
Yes.
Well, now, you go a great deal into the writings of Gorbachev, because this is the man, of course, who's being lauded and applauded here in the United States, hobnobbing with our leaders, given a special place in the Presidio to establish, first of all, the Gorbachev Foundation, and then which has now become the State of the World Forum. What are some of the things that Gorbachev has said in his writings and in his speeches suggest that the attitude of the American leaders towards him is ill-founded?
Oh, well, when you actually read Gorbachev's books, you find he's a very unreconstructed Marxist-Leninist who believes in the approaching future revolutionary storms. And what he says quite clearly in his books, he says the road to socialism is not a straight road. It is a road with many twists and turns in it. And of course, some of those twists and turns involve these maneuvers to collapse the Soviet Union, to get the West to disarm. And perestroika was Gorbachev's word. It was also Stalin's favorite word, and it means restructuring. Stalin meant by it putting his colleagues in front of firing squads and doing away with them. But Gorbachev meant restructuring the Western mind. And that restructuring took place through this kind of controlled liberalism that he gradually brought on, and then which led to the revolution. And you'll notice in 1985, the United States had 27 army divisions. Today, we have only 10 army divisions. In 1985, we had 37 Air Force wings. Today, we only have 13. In 1985, we had 540 6 ships in our Navy. Today we're down to 339 ships in our Navy. So perestroika has restructured the Western mind. It's moved us away from vigilance, and it's brought us into a position of having disarmed ourselves unilaterally.
But of course, the reply to that would be, but look, the Soviet army is living in rags and tatters. They can't even pay them. Soldiers are defecting from the Soviet army. The Soviet military is of no threat at all to America.
You know, the Soviet military, the living conditions of the soldiers were worse in 1945 when they conquered Hitler than they are today. If they could conquer Hitler under those same living conditions, they could do a lot of things. Morale is not simply conditioned. I know Napoleon said an army marches on its stomach, but morale is conditioned by many factors. What the Soviet strategists call the correlation of forces, and also now in the nuclear age, the correlation of nuclear forces.
And of course, the Soviet nuclear forces are far more powerful now than ever before.
Oh, yes.
And as we are unilaterally disarming, because our leaders think that war is impossible, and they believe war is winnable.
The Russians are cheating on nearly every arms control agreement they've made. They are saying that they will not meet the START 1 treaty limits by the year 2000, which means they're not taking apart their nuclear forces.
But that's because they don't have the money. If we just give them more money, maybe they could do it.
Of course, they don't have the money. On the one hand, they don't have the money to maintain their military. On the other hand, they don't have the money to disassemble it either.
Right.
You know, it makes one wonder what exactly is going on over there.
Well, you and I both know what's going on. Let's go to Barry, who's on the line here. And this is Dr. Barry, who's a host here on Radio Liberty on Tuesday evenings. Hi, Barry.
Well, hi. Great. Appreciate the show. It's absolutely dynamite here. Great stuff.
Well, of course, but that's true every night, Barry. Don't sound so surprised.
All right. Yeah, I wanted to ask...
But this is an exceptionally good program. I really feel that Jeff has a tremendous, tremendous grasp of what's going on. It's a real pleasure to have him on.
Yeah. Given his knowledge and insight, I was wondering if Jeff could possibly give us his thoughts about an AP story from day before yesterday that announces that that Russia has brought on to line and made combat ready the Topol M missile, 10 of these things. It's a brand new intercontinental ballistic missile that is mobile capable or of use, you know, launching from their mobile launchers, and they're planning on making 40 of these things. I guess by the year, through the year 2000, and if he's aware of them, or if he has any thoughts about what is the significance of them developing these new ICBMs?
Well, the significance of the road and rail mobile ICBM, especially the highly modern, accurate Topol, is the fact that you remember in the Gulf War, Saddam Hussein has these mobile launchers, the Scuds, and at the beginning of the war, with all of our national technical means focused on Iraq, looking for those Scuds so our fighter bombers can go out and knock them out, we thought he had like 50 of these launchers. It turns out he had 250 of them, and we couldn't destroy hardly any of them because of the mobility. The mobility of a launcher, a mobile launcher, is not the same as a missile silo. A missile silo is always going to be where it is, and you can always blast it. You can always turn it into a smoking hole in the ground. But these things, they can hide in caves, in tunnels, in underground bunkers. And you had a place like Yamato Mountain, and who knows how many of them they have underneath that mountain that can come crawling out from under the mountain and hit us. So this is this new weapon, because of its mobility, it's extremely defensible, extremely flexible, and with an intercontinental range, the rapidity of fire and the flexibility of use is tremendous. It's a fantastic weapon. We have nothing comparable to it in our armament.
We have no mobile intercontinental ballistic missiles, and we're effectively destroying a certain number of our missiles. We've destroyed about half of them already.
I think it's interesting. I read recently that Russia had exported the technology for leveling their mobile launcher vehicles to China.
And not only that, but they're, of course, giving them to Iran as well.
Well, China has just tested this month its version of this, its own mobile launcher, which I believe can reach as far as the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah, 8,500 miles of Long March 4, is it? Anyway, something like that.
It's a mobile launcher, and they tested it earlier this month.
Yeah, I was just absolutely flabbergasted when I learned, slightly over a month ago, that our policy apparently is that if a nuclear attack is launched at this country, that to do nothing until after impact.
We will take multiple hits, impacts, before we would reply, if there's anything to reply with at that point.
And so doesn't that set us up for our possible adversaries as trying to achieve a first strike knockout potential?
Yes, absolutely. There's one of the former leading analysts in the nuclear war field at the CIA was Peter Vincent Pry. He's no longer with the CIA, I understand. And he wrote a book in 1990 called Nuclear Wars, Exchanges and Outcomes. It's a rather technical book, and it was never in the bookstores, but I got a hold of it, and I tell you, what he analyzes nuclear war, and if a nuclear war happens, he points out, we're not going to start it, the Russians are going to start it, it's not going to be that they call up the day before saying, get ready, we're coming, they're going to surprise us. And he goes through the mechanics of nuclear war. What are these modern weapons? How do they work? How do you achieve surprise in a nuclear war? And what are the possibilities for the Russians getting a disarming first strike? And he concludes that the very best result, and this is in 1990 with the force levels that existed then, that the very best result for America is that we would be able to hit Russia back with only 308 megatons. That's the most optimistic assessment. He said the moderate assessment is that we'd be able to hit them back with about 78 megatons, and of course the worst outcome would be that they got us completely surprised and destroyed all of our weapons. This is the controversial part of the book. You know, we all know we have submarines underneath the water. He says, look, he says, everybody who knows physics knows that a submarine, no matter how deep it is in the water, when it moves, it leaves a wake on the surface of the water. Now, that wake is not immediately where the submarine is. A submarine could be a certain number of miles, 2, 3, 4 miles away from that wake. But if you take a 25 megaton warhead and you hit that wake with it, you create a shock wave in the water that destroys all submerged submarines within 18.9 kilometers. And he goes through the math in the book. He says they could use high yield weapons as depth charges, and they could knock out our ballistic missile submarines.
Can you comment about what is your understanding of the readiness of our nuclear retaliatory force? Maybe you could do that after the break.
Barry, would you mind hanging on?
We're
going to
certainly
take a break.
Thank you.
Here. Okay, fine. Well, Jeff, we'll be just taking a break here for about a minute, and then we'll be back. And let's give our telephone number again at 464-8295 or at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And, of course, I'd say to the people here in Santa Cruz, you do have something to worry about, despite the fact that as you enter the city of Santa Cruz, we have little signs that say this is a nuclear-free zone. I don't think the Chinese communists or the Russian communists really care what your city council says. They have an intense hatred for America, everything we stand for, even for the People's Republic of Santa Cruz. In fact, ordinarily, when they take over, the Marxists and the communists are the first ones who are destroyed. So hang on, we'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest this evening, Jeff Nyquist. And the more I talk to Jeff, the more I think we're probably going to carry his book here at Radio Liberty, because I think it's vitally important that you have access to this information. Don't even think about changing the dial.